Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, February 28th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Council Votes to Revise Building Ordinance. New approach would put in place fresh strategies to tackle dilapidated, vacant structures within city limits. By Ben Schaffer, staff writer. The City of Midland voted to revise a city ordinance that would introduce new strategies to address substandard, vacant buildings within city limits during its meeting on Tuesday. Mayor Lori Blong said there has been a long time of dilapidated structures in the community that have become hazards to the area. City Planning and Development Officer Elizabeth Triggs laid out the revised ordinance, the biggest change being that the city can board and secure buildings prior to a hearing if the building is substandard, vacant, and/or unlawfully occupied. The current ordinance creates a situation where the City of Midland has to wait at least 90 days prior to a vacant substandard property being secured. A building being secured means boarding it from entry, boarding windows and entry points, according to Triggs. In the current ordinance, the city building official would identify a building within city limits that violates minimum standards. Ordering the title report typically takes around 30 days. The building official would then send a notice of a public hearing to the property owner. After another 30-day period to correct standards violations, the City Council would hold a public hearing on the property. If the building was then deemed substandard, the City Council would issue an order for action to be taken at the property. If there still had been no compliance, the city could then act and secure and board the building. Triggs shared the revised ordinance, which allows the building official to identify a building that violates minimum standards, confirm that a building is unoccupied or unlawfully occupied, and immediately secure the building while notifying the property owner pre-hearing. The property owner may appeal within 30 days after receiving the notice. After an appeal is made, City Council conducts a hearing within 20 days. Council can reverse or approve the decision to board and secure the building at the hearing. In both ordinances, if the city incurs expenses in vacating, securing, or demolishing of the building, the city may assess them on the property and place a lien if necessary, Triggs shared. It's a lengthy process of at least 3 months before you can even move to secure the building, Triggs said about the current ordinance. In the meantime, that leaves a lot of room for there to be public safety issues, right? With the public accessing the building, or if the building is in such dangerous condition, just being a danger to the community around it. The city can secure and board a building immediately after the building officer determines it is substandard and vacant or unlawfully occupied under the proposed revision. Triggs said this will help streamline building safety codes and empower the city to act quickly, pre-hearing, when a building is a public safety threat, substandard and vacant or unlawfully occupied. Part of what brought this all to a head was really recognizing some of these crime hotspots, like is referenced in item number 1, where we recognized that we have certain things occurring in some places in Midland where we need to address them. We're addressing the crime after it's already happened, but we're not getting to the root of the cause. So this is going to give us the ability to get to the root of the concern, which is a substandard building where people are gathering that they shouldn't be, Blong said. If the new ordinance were in place, the city could immediately go and secure substandard vacant buildings around the city and begin to work with property owners through the process of demolition, should it come to that, Triggs said. This revision takes a 3-month boarding process and makes it possible in a few days, Triggs shared. There will be a second reading in March on the revised ordinance, according to the city. This article is entitled, Davidson Files for Special At-Large Election. Candidates now total 5. By Ben Schaffer, staff writer. Eric Davidson filed for the special at-large election on May 4th, bringing the total number of candidates to 5. Here is the list as of Tuesday, according to the City of Midland. James R. Bull Henry, date filed February 13th. John Burkholder, date filed February 20th. Cheston Blank, date filed February 20th. Ben Roberts, date filed February 23rd. Eric Davidson, date filed February 26th. This article is entitled, Feeling Like February. Wednesday's cold front will drop temps by 40 degrees. Rain likely too. By Anthony Franz, newsroom meteorologist. The last few days have definitely felt like February across West Texas. Temperatures reached the 80s in Midland-Odessa Sunday through Tuesday, and isolated spots in the Permian Basin even touched 90 degrees on Monday. If you're not ready for an early start to summer, don't worry. A strong cold front will surge quickly through the state on Wednesday morning, ushering in much colder air from the north. While temperatures are expected to stay above freezing, it will feel much more like February than it has lately. Here's everything you should know. Wednesday's temperatures. After reaching high temperatures in the low 80s Tuesday afternoon, temperatures will plummet Wednesday morning as the cold front slides through Midland-Odessa between 4 and 6 a.m. It will bring temperatures down quickly into the low 40s by 7 to 9 a.m., a 40-degree drop from the previous day. Morning wind speeds at 20 to 25 miles per hour will make things feel even colder, as wind chills drop to the low 30s at times. Temperatures will warm up slowly throughout the day, but West Texas will stay below average for late February. After temps hover in the 40s through the late morning, they'll rise to the 50-degree mark during the afternoon. Afternoon highs will reach about 51 to 52 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Rain chances. There's a slight chance of light showers in the afternoon and early evening, but rain chances are not expected to rise to their highest levels until after sunset Wednesday, especially after 7 to 8 p.m. Rain chances will stay high in the Permian Basin overnight, with decreasing chances after 3 a.m. Thursday morning. Rain is expected to stay quite light, with totals likely to stay less than 0.25 inch in Midland-Odessa. Slightly higher rainfall amounts are expected to the west toward the Trans-Pecos and Davis Mountains. Temperatures will drop into the mid to upper 30s during the early morning hours on Thursday. Since West Texas will stay above freezing, the predominant precipitation type is expected to be rain. However, it's not out of the question for a bit of snow to mix in, mainly in the northern Permian Basin and Guadalupe Mountains. An inch of snow is possible for the highest peaks of the Guadalupe Mountains, but no snow accumulations are expected in the Permian Basin. Quick warm-up. After a cloudy start, bright sunshine is expected by Thursday afternoon, and temperatures will rebound nicely. Highs are expected to reach the low 60s, about 5 to 10 degrees below average. The warm-up continues as we head into the weekend. Friday's high temperatures are expected to reach the mid-70s in Midland-Odessa, topping out in the upper 70s to low 80s by Saturday and Sunday, under mostly cloudy skies. However, Sunday will also bring wind speeds at 20 to 30 miles an hour, with some gusts up to 40 miles an hour possible. Long-range weather models are hinting at a weak cold front potentially moving into West Texas by Monday or Tuesday, but a significant cold front is not expected at this time. Temperatures will most likely only drop a bit closer to average. This article is entitled "Foul Play Ruled Out in Death of Dan Corrales." Justice of the Peace rules at large councilman's death was accidental. By Scott Nunn, staff writer. Foul play has been ruled out in the death of at-large Midland City Councilman Dan Corrales. According to a press release from Justice of the Peace Precinct 2 Judge David M. Cobos, the duties of coroner and medical examiner fall onto his office because the county does not have a medical examiner. Cobos said he was the on-call Justice of the Peace on January 30th when Corrales was found dead. An autopsy and toxicology report were immediately ordered by Cobos. The toxicology showed Corrales tested positive for ethanol and benzodiazepines. Mr. Corrales sustained a single gunshot wound on the right upper chest close to the shoulder, Cobos said in the release. The bullet traveled downward, passing through his right lung and liver. Mr. Corrales died as a result of exsanguination, blood loss. Cobos said after reviewing the investigation evidence, autopsy, toxicology, and other evidence in the case, he consulted with the Midland Police Department and Texas Rangers. There is zero evidence at hand to suggest the involvement of any other person in Mr. Corrales' death except by his own hand, Cobos said. I further believe, based on the evidence at hand, that Mr. Corrales did not intend to end his life, but the unintended consequence of his self-inflicted gunshot resulted in his death. Therefore, I have ruled his manner of death was accidental, not suicide, he continued. Common sense dictates that there are other places on one's body to shoot themselves to end their life immediately. Mr. Corrales did not leave any notes, letters, voicemails, or tell anyone he was intending to end his life. This article is entitled "Keep Midland Beautiful Gets Pay Raise for Program" by B.K. Richter, staff writer. Keep Midland Beautiful and the City of Midland announced the Trash for Cash program has been granted a significant pay raise. According to a press release from the nonprofit, the amount of money per person, per hour, is now $10. That is an overall increase of $2.50 an hour from the original rate of $7.50. Another increase that the nonprofit announced is the opportunity for groups to earn up to $600 per cleanup. Your group can now earn up to $600 per cleanup, with a total of $3,600 available to earn every year, the release stated. Now, if your group has 20 people cleaning for 3 hours, each at $10 per person, your group will earn $600. Before today, if your group had 20 people cleaning for 3 hours at $7.50 per person, your group would have earned $450. Joy Paulson, the executive director of KMB, said the Trash for Cash program is funded via a grant with the City of Midland. She said the Trash for Cash program is allotted $130,000 per year. We roughly get $9,000 per month for the Trash for Cash program, she said during a phone interview with the Reporter Telegram. As our city grows, so does the trash. KMB's Trash for Cash program is designed to help other nonprofits within the area fundraise, including school programs. We supply the gloves, vests, and trash bags, KMB wrote in its press release. You supply the people and hours picking up litter. As far as the amount of trash that is recovered within the Midland area, Paulson said the most that she has seen from one group of 20 individuals was over 400 pounds of trash. It can range from 100 pounds to 600 pounds. It just depends on the area and the number of volunteers, she said. Paulson added that last year, with all of the combined KMB programs, close to 90 tons of trash was collected. We had more than 30,000 hours of trash collection, and 8,000 trash bags were distributed with all of the programs combined, she explained. Another detail Paulson shared was that KMB's primary collection area does not include major highways or roadways. We take care of local in-town cleanups, she said. A lot of people confuse us with the Texas Department of Transportation, but that's not us. Paulson added that the pay increase for the Trash for Cash program is exciting because a raise has not been distributed in several years. We want to use those funds that are available, she said. We want to encourage these local community groups and other nonprofits to join in our programs. More information regarding KMB's Trash for Cash program can be found on its website at keepmidlandbeautiful.org under Programs. Since 1983, Keep Midland Beautiful has developed grassroots environmental education and programming that encourages people in Midland to care for the community by preventing litter, reducing waste, recycling, and maintaining beautiful spaces. KMB is an affiliate of Keep Texas Beautiful and Keep America Beautiful. The Great American Cleanup begins on Friday. This article is entitled Library at the Plaza Closed Until Monday by Ben Schaffer, staff writer. The library at the plaza was temporarily closed on Monday and is scheduled to reopen next Monday for air handler maintenance. During the closure, the library's online resources, including downloadable content, books, audiobooks, and streaming movies, will still be available, according to a press release from Midland County Public Libraries. The bookmobile will be available at the Library at the Plaza location Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Patrons may pick up, return, or check out library materials, according to MCPL. Scheduled passport appointments will be honored, according to MCPL. Persons with an appointment scheduled may access the passports office through the library's east side entrance next to the hot air balloon sculpture, the press release states. Regularly scheduled storytime programs at the library at the plaza will be held at Centennial Library. Bilingual storytime will be on Monday at 4:30 p.m. On Thursday, Book Babies will be at 10:30 a.m. and Toddler Tales will be at 11:30 a.m. The library at the plaza will resume normal business hours next Tuesday. Midland County approved an emergency closing pay for full-time employees at the library at the plaza on Monday. This is the business and oil page. Lower gas prices may make ICEs more affordable to fuel up than EVs. Study. By Brianna Noble, The Detroit News. With gasoline prices dropping, a new study suggests gas-powered vehicles may be more economic to fuel up versus an equivalent electric vehicle. Entry-level gas-powered cars like the Honda Civic and Subaru Impreza had an average fueling cost of $9.46 per 100 purposeful miles, which are defined as those going to a destination, not a gas or charging station, according to the East Lansing-based consulting firm Anderson Economic Group, which has done business for automakers like General Motors Company, Ford Motor Company, and Honda Motor Company Limited, auto suppliers, and groups like the Nature Conservancy. The cost for 100 miles of operating similarly segmented EVs like the Nissan Leaf or now defunct Chevrolet Bolt was estimated at $12.55 when charging mostly at home, based on U.S. Energy Information Administration energy cost data, which typically records Michigan electricity prices – higher than the national average. The cost jumped to $15.98 with mostly commercial charging. With electricity prices steady and gas prices slightly down, Patrick Anderson, study author, said in a statement, "We continued to see most traditional gas-powered vehicles as more economical to fuel than their EV counterparts in late 2023. There was one exception to the higher costs for EVs. When charged mostly at home, luxury EVs like the Tesla Model S and Mercedes-Benz EQS came out at $13.50 per 100 purposeful miles, compared to $17.81 using mostly commercial charging. The cost was $17.30 for gas-powered luxury vehicles like the Cadillac CT5 and Lexus ES. For pickup trucks, fueling up a Ford F-Series truck, Chevrolet Silverado, Ram 1500, or other gas-powered options was estimated at $17 per 100 purposeful miles. It was $16.86 for diesel. Charging an F-150 Lightning or a Rivian RIT mostly at home came out to $17.75, and mostly using commercial chargers raised the cost to $26.39. This article is entitled "Ranger's Outreach Helps Conquer Food Insecurity" by B.K. Richter, staff writer. Nearly 4 million Texans experience food insecurity. For West Texans, the problem is especially prevalent due to the lack of accessibility of grocery stores. For the founders of Rangers Outreach, Inc., a Greenwood-based nonprofit that aims to provide weekly food bags and other necessities to students and their families who are economically disadvantaged, putting together food bags has become an all-encompassing way of life. Co-founder Jessica Rich and board treasurer Kenzie Addy were both on hand to explain the nonprofit's mission and how the agency utilizes all volunteers to fill a need in their community. "We started back in April of 2023, so we're still brand new," Rich told the Reporter Telegram during an interview. From there, the nonprofit hosts adult volunteers who come and stock the food shelves for the nonprofit, as well as students from the local high schools. The next step is putting together weekly food bags to provide local economically disadvantaged students with groceries that they might otherwise not have access to. "The counselors on the school campuses tell us how many bags they need," Rich said while describing the nonprofit's programming. "In addition to helping with providing groceries for a family that would otherwise have none offered, the nonprofit provides backpacks, clothing, shoes, and even personal hygiene bags for students. When the weather turned cold, we started getting phone calls from the counselors describing families who had no heat in their homes. So we were able to get blankets and heaters to these families," Rich said. Rich also stressed that the nonprofit is currently 100% community funded. "Nobody works for money," she said. "We are staffed by businesses that bring in their employees to help us stuff food bags or volunteer to help stock our shelves." Rich credits the Greenwood community for stepping up and filling the needs within the community. "When we ask, people do show up and help when we need it," she explained. The Rangers Outreach Program prepares between 200 and 250 grocery bags each week for students, and those food bags are carefully crafted to serve the individual and the family they are intended for. Rich said children with food allergies are especially in need of this kind of individualized attention. "We had one girl with a lactose allergy," she said, "and she was just overwhelmed when her bag was given to her because someone had taken the time to consider her needs first." While the nonprofit has grown significantly within the last year, much of the growth centered on establishing a better understanding of the need of its clients. When we started, we had high school students that very much needed food bags, but they would not take them because they were embarrassed, Rich said. And so, we found a way to disguise these bags. The growth of the nonprofit also included partnering with companies such as Chick-fil-A and other nonprofits within the region. As one of the two major fundraisers, the nonprofit plans to host their first fundraiser of the year, a clay shoot with the Natural Gas Society of the Permian Basin. The clay shoot is slated for April 5th. For more information, guests can register at ngspb.com/event/ngspb-clay-shoot. Rich said that at the end of the day, the nonprofit's mission is ultimately wanting these kids to feel special and to be excited about their food. For more information about Rangers Outreach and their mission, visit rangersoutreach.com. This article is entitled "Texans in Panhandle Region Flee Expanding Wildfires" from the Associated Press. Canadian Texas. A rapidly widening Texas wildfire more than doubled in size Tuesday and prompted evacuation orders in small towns as strong winds, dry grass, and unseasonably warm temperatures fueled the blaze in the state's rural panhandle. Republican Governor Greg Abbott issued a disaster declaration for 60 counties as the largest fire burned nearly 400 square miles, according to the Texas A&M Forest Service. That is more than twice its size since the fire sparked Monday. Authorities have not said what might have caused the blaze. Texans are urged to limit activities that could create sparks and take precautions to keep their loved ones safe, Abbott said. The largest blaze, known as the Smokehouse Creek Fire, closed highways and remained 0% contained as of Tuesday afternoon, according to the Forest Service. Multiple fires were reported across Hemphill and Hutchinson counties near the Oklahoma border. Texas State Senator Kevin Sparks said an evacuation order was issued for the town of Canadian, a town of about 2,000, about 100 miles northeast of Amarillo, and other areas. Later Tuesday, the Hemphill County Sheriff's Office urged anyone who remained in Canadian to shelter in place or at the high school gym because roads were closed. Evacuations were also ordered in nearby Miami, and schools in Canadian and Miami announced closures Wednesday. East of Canadian, fire officials across the border in the area of Durham, Oklahoma, also encouraged people to evacuate because of the fire. Evacuations were also taking place in Skellytown, Wheeler, Allison, and Briscoe, according to the National Weather Service in Amarillo. About 40 miles southwest of Canadian, city officials in Pampa on Facebook suggested that residents evacuate to the south and said buses were available for that purpose. To the west, at least some residents in the small city of Fritch were told to leave their homes Tuesday afternoon because of another fire that had jumped a highway. By Tuesday evening, the fires were 20 to 25 miles from Amarillo, and wind was blowing wildfire smoke into the city, which could affect people with respiratory issues, Weather Service officials said. This is the Life Tributes column. Bertha Betty Flores. Bertha Betty Flores, age 87, went to be with the Lord on February 25th. Cremation services have been arranged. Funeral arrangements have been entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home, and online condolences can be made at asanchezTFH.com. Margarita Gallegos de Rey. Margarita Gallegos de Rey, 65, passed away February 26th in Midland. Viewing was held on Tuesday, February 27th, at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Funeral services will be in her hometown of Alito, Mahoma, Chihuahua, Mexico. Funeral arrangements are under the direction and care of Avalos, Sanchez, and Thomas Funeral Home. Online condolences can be made at asanchezTFH.com. Danny Marroquin. Danny Marroquin, 61, passed away on Monday, February 26th. Viewing will be Thursday, February 29th, from 12 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral service is set for Friday, March 1st at 10 a.m., also at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Funeral service is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home, and family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Jesus Murillo Siller. Jesus Murillo Siller, 61, passed away on Sunday, February 25th. Viewing will be Wednesday, February 28th, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., with a prayer service to begin at 7 p.m. at Heavenly Gate Chapel. Funeral service is set for Thursday, February 29th at 10 a.m., also at Heavenly Gate Chapel. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Funeral service is under the direction of Heavenly Gate Funeral Home and Chapel, and family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Baltasar Rascón. Baltasar Rascón, age 73, went to be with the Lord February 19th. Cremation services have been arranged. Funeral arrangements have been entrusted to Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home, and online condolences can be made at asanchezTFH.com. Felipe C. Rodriguez. Felipe C. Rodriguez, 87, passed away on Sunday, February 25th. Graveside service will be Wednesday, February 28th at 10 a.m. at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Graveside service is under the direction of Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home, and family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com.
It's Still Cold and Flu Season by Taylor Sutton, MS, RDN, LD, United Supermarket Dietitian. Did you know that the highest rates of cold and flu tests are actually in February? Well, now that you know, it's time to take action. There are so many things you can do as a dietitian. There are some foods that you can use to better support your immune system to keep yourself well. Probiotics are powerhouses. We've heard of this one time and time again to create a healthy gut, since the majority of our immune system lives there. While supplements can have a role, whole food sources like kimchi, sauerkraut, miso, tempeh, yogurt, kefir, cottage cheese, pickles, and sourdough will be better absorbed. Zinc helps regulate the immune system and maintain the integrity of the skin, which is one of the first lines of defense against infection. If there isn't enough in the system, it can delay wound healing and suppress the immune system from functioning properly. A few foods like eggs, beef, poultry, oysters, shrimp, milk, nuts, whole grains, and beans are good sources of this nutrient. A few studies show that zinc supplementation can help reduce the duration and severity of common colds in healthy individuals. Vitamin C consumption and supplementation is hit and miss. The bottom line is that supplementation won't hurt you, but it might help. While citrus foods take the cake on this one, other foods like bell peppers, strawberries, and kiwis are also good sources of this vitamin. When looking for a supplement, look for 250 milligrams at one time, as that is what is absorbed. Anything higher, and it may be excreted. beta-glucans from fungi and yeast support immune system function. This nutrient can easily be found in mushrooms and brewer's yeast. You can find mushrooms in the fresh, frozen, canned, and living well section of your stores easily. Elderberry supplementation may help support the immune system and help ease cold and flu symptoms. It is rich in antioxidants and vitamins. Some cultures have considered it to be one of the world's oldest and most healing plants. Outside of these specific nutrients found in foods, make sure you are getting plenty of fluids, regular physical activity, 7 to 9 hours of quality sleep, and maintaining your current weight. Easy beef tenderloin. Ingredients: 1 pound beef tenderloin, 1/4 cup pistachios, 1/4 cup fresh rosemary, 1 teaspoon freshly ground black pepper, 1 tablespoon olive oil, 1 teaspoon Dijon mustard, 1 tablespoon lemon juice, and 1 tablespoon of honey. Directions. Number 1. Preheat the oven to 425 degrees. Number 2. In a small blender, pulse the pistachios until a powder forms. Number 3. Mince rosemary. Number 4. In a bowl, mix together the pistachio crumbs, rosemary, pepper, olive oil, Dijon mustard, lemon juice, and honey into a paste-like consistency. Number 5. Pat and spread over beef tenderloin. Number 6. Place in cast iron skillet for 25 to 30 minutes, testing for desired doneness at the 35, 40, and 45-minute mark. The longer it goes, the more well done it will become, with 135 being medium rare. Number 7. Transfer tenderloin to cutting board and tent with foil to rest for 10 minutes. Number 8. Slice and enjoy. OPD email: charges upgraded in annex incident. OANews@OAOA.com. An email from OPD Sergeant J. Gonzalez, obtained under the Texas Public Information Act, details charges against two candidates involved in a physical altercation outside the courthouse annex during early voting have been upgraded to a Class A for both and referred to the offices of the district attorney / county attorney. Fake news sites have incorrectly suggested there are more witnesses and other police reports, but the original report was the only one that came back from a TPIA request to the city. The only witnesses listed were Donna Kelm, Armin Wilhite, and Linda Hall. The report is not the end of the investigation. The OPD report details Hall's eyewitness account shows GOP Precinct 203 chair candidate Carmen Wilhite's statements to police that she was the victim in a confrontation between her and GOP County chair candidate Donna Kelm are not true. Various social media reports and press release from the Ector County GOP painted Kelm as the responsible party and falsely called Wilhite a campaign worker. But according to the official report by OPD officer Bobby Pietropaolo, witness Hall said Kelm did gently touch Carmen on the arm before Carmen pulled away. Linda states that Donna did not appear to be threatening or aggressive towards Carmen. The report states Kelm, 66, told officers she gently touched Carmen's arm in a non-aggressive way so she can simply request Carmen to not accuse her of being a Democrat, SIC. She stated when Carmen, 62, flung her arm back, she grabbed Donna by the back of her hair and yanked on it, causing her pain and believing she may have pulled some hair out of her head. Hall, who is running for Precinct 1, said it was Wilhite who attacked Kelm, not the other way around. I'm going to tell you, I have worked over there 2 days with Carmen, and for 2 days she has tried to antagonize me. She has told everybody that I'm a Democrat, Hall, 69, said Thursday night. She does anything that she can to belittle and try to stir up trouble, and I told her yesterday and today to stop talking about me, to stop interrupting me, and to leave me alone, and she says, I'm the aggressor. Again and again, Wilhite interrupted her while she was speaking with voters, Hall said. She would just walk up and start saying, she's not telling you the truth. We're the real Republicans. They're Democrats, Hall said. I felt so intimidated, I went and stayed by my pickup for safety reasons. Wilhite didn't respond to questions about the altercation. Kelm said Thursday night she was resting per doctor's orders and was shocked at how Wilhite claimed she attacked her at the Ector County Annex. I just touched her shoulder, Kelm said. I didn't grab her. I touched her on the shoulder and was trying to say, come on, stop saying I'm a Democrat. And she yanked my hair out. Kelm was treated by a doctor and was told to rest. According to the OPD report, Wilhite wanted to file charges and she was given a case number and advised to contact municipal court. Kelm also reported the assault followed her doctor's appointment. OPD continues to investigate. Kelm is running against GOP County Chair Tisha Crow and Will Hite against Odessa businessman Ronnie Lewis. Lewis, though his Ector County Politics Facebook page, reminded people Thursday night that he warned them Wednesday night that Will Hite was being aggressive and dishonest. Tisha Crow and Jeff Russell held a two-day seminar for her appointed precinct chair on disrupting opponents and subversion, Lewis wrote. They're using their training. He wrote he was proud of Kelm for stepping up and running against Crow and asked for prayers for her. This is Christy, and I'll be reading Odessa American for Wednesday, February 28, 2024. Documents show Mayor Hoven behind text to Gerke. Attorney questions city using resources to hide identity, by Kim Smith, oanews@oaoa.com. Earlier this month, Ector County District Attorney Dusty Gallivan asked the Texas Rangers to look into allegations someone falsely reported. Republican agitator Matt Cote was burglarizing homes and people at City Hall were abusing their power by hiding that person's name. Documents obtained by the Odessa American Tuesday revealed the person who texted Odessa Police Chief Mike Gerke about someone walking around in and out of houses on December 18th was Odessa Mayor Javier Hoven. On Tuesday, the OA received copies of the text messages the paper already obtained earlier this month about the events of that morning, but this time, two pages contain the following words at the bottom. Exhibit B, highlighted portion, redacted and released to requester. Confidential informant, mayor of the city of Odessa, called in suspicious vehicle in neighborhood. Cote's attorney, former Ector County District Attorney Bobby Bland, said he has forwarded the documents to Gallivan, asking him to send them to the Texas Rangers. I find it extremely troubling, and more than ever, this needs to be investigated for criminal activity, Bland said. The fact that the city is using its resources to protect the mayor and describe him as a confidential informant is shocking. During the 15 years I was DA, when I saw confidential informant, that meant somebody that was turning state evidence, usually because they had information on a stash house. In this case, we've got the mayor calling or texting the chief of police and giving what my client says is false information, trying to frame my client. Gallivan said he has not yet heard if the Texas Rangers will investigate Cote's allegations, but he confirmed he will be forwarding documents he recently received from Bland to the agency. According to records obtained by the Odessa American under the Texas Public Information Act, Gerke received a text from someone on December 18th stating they had seen someone near Bainbridge Drive in the country club area walking around in and out of houses. The texter also told Gerke the man was driving a Ford F-250 and provided him with a license plate that returned to Cote, reports stated. Officers were unable to find Cote in the area or at his apartment, but contacted him by phone. Cote recorded all of the conversations he had with various OPD staff about why they were seeking to speak with him. The conversations indicate the officers were acting at the behest of someone who had texted Gerke. Cote repeatedly sought to find out who asked the police to find him. According to the police report, Cote refused to tell officers if he had been in the area or not, and he was told who called the police on him. Since there was no crime that had been committed, Corporal Taylor Miley and Sergeant John Faust were instructed to just do information narratives on the incident, Captain Darrell Smith wrote in his report. Cote contacted the Odessa American upset. OPD did not investigate the texter for false reporting. Cote is well known for calling out Hoven and council members Denise Swenner and Mark Mata on Facebook. He regularly hazes Swenner for once posting she had lunch with Wasaya Varkas, which is a fake Facebook profile used to bully Odessans, and has accused the trio of Ector County Republican Chairwoman Tisha Crow of supporting controversial figure Casey Gray over Representative Brooks Landgraf during the last election, and also of bullying via Facebook fake profiles. Cote said he was visiting his parents in Andrews at the time of the call, and someone aligned with Crow and the others texted Gerke. Chris and Tisha Crowe live in the area where Cote was reported as being seen. Cote believes officials aligned with that group could be abusing their positions by not investigating the texter and by shielding his or her identity. Neither Cote nor the Odessa American have been able to get the texter's name via Public Information Act requests. While the city provided the OA several texts, it's difficult to discern who wrote some of them, as either the names have been redacted or cut off. Adding to the confusion is the fact several of the texts were apparently copied and pasted to multiple individuals. On February 11th, the Odessa American filed a subsequent public records request asking for all text messages exchanged between Hoven and Swenner, Swenner and Gerke, and Hoven and Gerke on December 18th, regardless of whether they were on private phones or city phones. The city responded, "There are no additional records responsive to your request. All records were released in your previous requests, and Councilwoman Swenner has no messages from December 18, 2023. In response to the OA's original TPIA seeking the police report and text, City Attorney Dan Jones asked the Texas Attorney General's office on December 29th for permission to keep the texter's name private. The text message was sent out to the chief of police with the assumption of staying anonymous and listed as a confidential informant, Jones wrote. The city believes that the release of this information would cause harm to the complainant and deter them from submitting future complaints. He also told the AG's office the case was actively being investigated and charges could be brought, and releasing the texter's name could hinder investigators. On February 5th, Jones sent a follow-up email to the AG's office making a new argument. Citing the Cote Police Department report number, Jones told the AG that the complainant was notifying the police chief of a possible SIC stalking situation. The texts received by the OA from the morning make no reference to stalking, nor do the police report, nor do the police reports. Bland believes there is a possibility that Hoven texted Gerke with secondhand information, but regardless, he does not believe Hoven's name should have been redacted, even if that was the case. The Texas Rangers need to be made aware the city is using its resources to protect a conversation between the mayor and one of its subordinates, the chief of police. I don't know how you can label the mayor of the city of Odessa, Javier Hoven, a confidential informant when you're trying to shield that information from the public, and then on top of it, we still have the problem of the city is trying to protect the identity of the mayor and not inquiring into where this false information came from, Bland said. Someone should be asking the mayor where he got this information and what is the basis of it, and was he knowingly providing false information to the police? Bland also pointed out the text was written in close proximity to a two-day training the Ector County Republican Party hosted for its intelligence op team. This text comes shortly after Hoven is listed on a document from the Ector County Republican Party and their training regarding subterfuge and attacking political enemies, and Mr. Cote is clearly someone who could be identified as a political enemy of Javier Hoven, Bland said. Hoven, who had a council workshop and council meeting Tuesday, did not respond to a request for comment sent between meetings. Odessa. James Weldon Doc Johnson left this world and went to spend eternity with his Lord and Savior on February 24, 2024. Services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, March 2, 2024 at Frank W. Wilson Funeral Directors with Pastor Lindell Lee officiating. Intermit will follow, led by Pastor Rick at 4 p.m. at the Rocky Creek Cemetery in Brownwood, Texas. Waco. Beverly Mae Scott went to be with her Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, on February 17, 2024. A private family memorial will be held in Waco, Texas, and a public celebration of life visitation will be held Saturday, April 13, 2024, from 11 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at Westminster Presbyterian Church at 4901 Maple Avenue, Odessa, Texas, 79762. In lieu of flowers, the family has requested memorial donations made to either Odessa Physical Therapy, please mark Boots Scott Scholarship, 4407 North Grandview Avenue, Odessa, Texas, 79762, or BSW Hospice of Waco, please mark In Memory of Boots Scott, 2911 Herring Avenue, Suite 310, Waco, Texas, 76708. Tony says, "How do I enroll in Medicare?" by Guest View, February 28, 2024. by Tony King. Hello, Tony. I am turning 65 in July, and I am bombarded with mail and telemarketing calls. I'm not receiving Social Security, and a friend who just got Medicare is receiving her Social Security check. Do I have to be receiving my Social Security check to get Medicare? Please explain what I should do, because I was waiting to apply for Social Security when I can receive 100% of my Social Security benefits. Currently, I have an individual health plan with a $6,000 deductible, and having Medicare benefits would be a blessing. Thanks. Joan from Phoenix, Arizona. Hi, Joan. Enrolling in Medicare can be very confusing. Most people think that when they turn 65, a magical switch flips on and poof, they are on Medicare. Medicare does not enroll you into Medicare. Social Security is the governmental agency that enrolls America into Medicare. Chapter 1 of Tony's Medicare Survival Guide Advanced Edition discusses different situations for enrolling in Medicare the right way. Let's discuss how to take your Medicare at the right time. Situation number 1. Turning 65 and receiving your Social Security check. This is the simplest way to receive your Medicare card. Social Security will notify Medicare that you have turned 65. Medicare will send your Welcome to Medicare kit 90 days before you turn 65 with your Medicare card in the kit. Remember, Social Security processes the paperwork for Medicare. Joan, this was your friend's situation because she was receiving her Social Security check. Situation 2. Turning 65 and still working, talk to your employer's human resources department. Ask if you need to enroll in Part B. If you do not need Part B because you are still working or your spouse is still working and you have health benefits, you may want to delay your Part B. You may want to enroll in Medicare Part A, hospital only. Situation 3. Turning 65 and not receiving your Social Security check and not covered by your or your spouse's employer's health benefits. Individuals approaching 65 under these circumstances need to initiate their own enrollment online at ssa.gov. It's a good idea to open a ssa.gov account well before you turn 65. Joan, this is your Medicare situation because you want to enroll in Medicare and are still working or may not be working but are waiting past 65 to receive 100% of your Social Security. If you have trouble opening a ssa.gov account, contact your local Social Security office or call the Social Security's 800 number 1-800-772-1213 for assistance. Now let's go over how to apply online at www.ssa.gov/Medicare/sign-up and what information you'll need to enroll. Number 1, name, Social Security number, gender, and date of birth. Number 2, contact information, including address, phone number, email address. Number 3, citizen information about you with what language you read and speak. Number 4, questions about your health benefits. Number 5, then submit your application online and view your receipt, which will alert you to any additional information required, such as your marriage license if you are short of the required 40 quarters and need to apply under your spouse's Medicare benefits or original citizenship papers if you are a naturalized citizen. Number 6, your beneficiary verification letter will be available on your Social Security account when your Medicare application is processed. The BVL includes your Medicare number and Part A and or B effective dates. Your new Medicare card will arrive by mail, or you can download your Medicare card by going to Medicare.gov and accessing your Medicare account. Your Medicare.gov account contains all your Medicare information. Readers, there are specific Medicare rules which everyone must follow. Remember, with Medicare, it's what you don't know that will hurt you. Tony's new course, Confused About Medicare, a downloadable video series, and the Medicare Survival Guide Advanced Edition, available at www.tonysays.com.
This is the Dear Abby column. In-laws keep spouses off family-only text thread. Dear Abby, I was recently married and was excited to be part of my husband's family. My own siblings and I are not particularly close. During COVID, one of my husband's sisters started a family text chain in which they share what's happening in their lives. I thought it was a great idea. Not technically being a family member yet, I understood why I wasn't included in the thread. But after our wedding, I wasn't added to the chain. Come to find out, none of the spouses are included. I have also learned from my husband that his mother really had no use for any of her kids' spouses, because technically, quote, we are not one of them, unquote. They aren't sharing earth-shattering information with one another. It's normally fun stuff or things their kids are up to, etc. It is very hurtful that I'm not included. I have to hear everything secondhand from my husband. Am I wrong to feel this way? I asked him to add me to the list and he tried, but he couldn't. Instead of pursuing it with his sister, he just dropped it. I have asked him several times to see what he can do to no avail. I feel like he doesn't have my back. Your advice? Signed, Left Out in Florida. Dear Left Out, your husband doesn't have enough power in his family to do what you have been requesting, which is regrettable. Rather than pout, consider starting a text chain of your own, comprising of all the outcasts who have been excluded from, quote, our bloodline and nobody else, unquote, chain. It might be fun, and you may find it's a club that is welcoming and has some interesting things to say. Dear Abby, my wife of 26 years is having an affair with another married man. We have teenage kids, and so does he. She has been having him over and meeting him out for the last 4 months. The kids have noticed how she takes off in the middle of the day for hours to do a solo hike. Several times, my teenage daughter has called me at work, frantic, saying Mom is not answering either of her phones and was supposed to pick her up at the agreed-upon location. My wife claims to love us both and wants to continue both relationships. For our family's sake, it is sad that this has happened. He is the manager of a local business, and I encounter him from time to time. I want to ask him how he thinks this is okay. What should I do? Signed, Sharing Her in Massachusetts. Dear Sharing Her, make up your mind about what kind of marriage you want. If it's what you are experiencing now, do nothing. However, if it isn't, tell your wandering wife she must end the affair now. Offer her the option of counseling to see if you can get your marriage back on track. Instead of talking with the man she's having the fling with, tell his wife what has been happening if she's unaware. That your wife is so irresponsible that she would leave her daughter stranded while she's hiking is disgraceful. If your wife refuses counseling, contact an attorney. You can contact Dear Abby at www.dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.